Homies, we have a very intelligent genius with us today.
It doesn't matter really your sport, especially when you're that good. We just have to create solutions below that level.
One of the most sought after professionals worldwide in physical therapy and athletic performance.
If you don't eat and stimulate muscle tissue, the human growth hormone doesn't automatically just make you diesel.
Dr. Charlie Wankroff.
I'm like, yo, if you weigh 250 pounds more than me, you have to squat 100 pounds more than me. How did I not think they were on steroids? If doing a bunch of leg extensions negatively affects your squat, then you're a bad coach. Like that shouldn't have happened. At some point in powerlifting, there's always going to be somebody stronger than you. If you don't eat or train, then the human growth hormone doesn't make you look like a monster.
Can you catch up to current powerlifting champions?
What if I told you that...
But anyways, guys, homies, we have a very intelligent genius with us today.
Who that?
Dr. Charlie Wankroff. He is one of the most sought after professionals worldwide in physical therapy and athletic performance. He is a doctor of physical therapy, a certified athletic trainer, and a certified strength and conditioning specialist who has worked with countless A-list celebrities, professional athletes, as well as the general population. Well, something that I've really found super dope is like all the companies and like the associations and everyone that you work with. He's worked with the Nike Executive Performance Council, lead physical therapist for the United States Marine Corps Special Operations Command, head and strength conditioning coach for the Philadelphia 76ers in the NBA, director of athletic development for the Roderick Greenberg Tennis Academy. There's so much things.
That's an old one, man. You got it. You have an old one.
But yeah, basically now, right now, currently, I'm assuming that right now you are the physical performance lead and head strength and conditioning coach for the Canadian.
Oh, so that you're, that what currently? You have is, what you have is definitely old. So about a year and a half ago, I moved on from Canada basketball.
Okay.
I still work with a lot of the, you know, guys privately. Mm-hmm. So no, that one is no longer active.
Okay. Nice.
If that's of interest to talk about, like there's some good anecdotes though, of when we started that in around 2011. And for those that follow basketball, hands down, Canada is, and I'm American, but they brought me to kind of do some cool things. Mm-hmm. Canada is clearly this, for a long time, has been the second best basketball country on earth. And now at the international level, we're probably the second best talent. Now, who wins, because mm-hmm. who shows up to play is always very, very, very different. But and there's also a lot of other really good countries. But to see right now, most players in the NBA, not from America, Canada, most number one picks overall, Canada, like this is, there are players that you don't even know are Canadian 4 or 5 years ago because they just go to American colleges and even American high schools. And now it's kind of a thing now because there's Shea, Jamal Murray, RJ Barrett. I started with RJ, I think he was 13. And you know, these are all players, like if you follow basketball, these are the real deal. It's more than just Tristan Thompson and Corey Joseph, who were the first of like this current generation. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, everybody knows Steve Nash, Todd McCullough. There's a Rick Fox was, you know, there's a lot of, and ironic that they played here, but now the group, and it was cool to be able to be a part of that, especially not being Canadian, even though if I have a little Canadian accent every now and then, like, that's weird. What is he saying? Because that's the Canadian accent.
Nice.
So that is not current. So, and, gotcha. But that's cool.
Out of curiosity though, how come basketball?
Oh, wow. So, when I was in PT school, I thought that it was going to be football, like American football. It was going to be military or pediatric physiotherapy. And I probably said that enough times. I'm actually highly trained in pediatric physiotherapy for lack of better terminology, challenged children. Mm-hmm. And I never really talk about those things because I think talking about it is kind of like exploiting these challenged children. But there's been times like, not very long, but very early in my career, like that was a very viable choice. Like I was going to work with kids that are CP, Down syndrome, you know, a lot of these developmental delay, et cetera. So, well, why do I say that? Well, when basketball was just kind of thrown in front of me, where I did an internship in undergrad at a physical therapy office in my town. And then I would go back every year to be like a tech, an aide, like at that time, $10 an hour or whatever. And one summer I had just gotten my ATC. So I wasn't a physical therapist yet, but I was a certified athletic trainer and I was in PT school. And Asbury Park is kind of part of the Jersey Shore, not Jersey Shore that you saw on TV. That's where I grew up. Seaside Heights is where Jersey Shore on MTV took place. Toms River is where I grew up. So Asbury Park's a little bit more north. It's mostly well known for Bruce Springsteen's videos, because Bruce Springsteen's from like the Jersey Shore. And they were the Asbury Park Convention Center, either that or Convention Hall, it was being revamped and they were going to bring minor league basketball. It was going to be what would basically be like double A level minor league basketball. And the team doctors were a huge referral source to where I was a tech. The gentleman I worked for was named Joe Napolitano. And the doctors asked, hey, Joe, I know it's not physical therapy, but do you happen to know any athletic trainers? I got into basketball. And the head coach was Rick Barry, who is one of the all-time greats. The assistant coach was Clifford Ray, who maybe not one of the all-time greats, but he was 1975 Rookie of the Year, et cetera. A few years before that summer, which I think was the summer of 98, he was an assistant coach with the New Jersey Nets. And I said, at the end of 99, I said, Clifford, hey, not for nothing, but when you were on Coach Butch, Butch Beard was a head coach. When you were on Coach Butch's staff, is it the same athletic trainer? Maybe there's a hookup or something. He's like, here's his name. Call him, drop my name, see what happens. So I kind of in basketball, which I was never, it was just kind of the cool thing to do. And it fit my physical therapy school schedule because it was in the summer. Whatever year was, so that would have been the fall of 99. We finished the 99 season. Clifford gave me Ted Arzonico's number with the New Jersey Nets. I called Thursday. I interviewed Friday, and I was in the NBA on Sunday. So it's like this, if I didn't become a tech or an aide with that Joe Napolitano, none of this would have happened. So from there, everything was basketball. Everything gotcha. Was basketball. And I was with the Nets, went to the minor leagues. Now it's known as the G League, but it was called the D League in the beginning. And I was in the inaugural year there. And then I got back to the NBA with the 76ers there for several years. Then, I wasn't retained and I came back home and just worked, that's kind of almost when social media kind of started, at least in my side of the profession. And then I went to Marine Corps Special Operations, MARSOC, which is now called the Raiders. When I was there, it wasn't called the Raiders. The thing was, little boys grow up saying they want to be an Army Ranger or a Navy SEAL. Little boys don't grow up saying, I want to be in MARSOC, because the Marines is always going to be different and do their own, they do things in a very, very different way. And then when I came back, that's when I kind of do my own thing in terms of, working in a lot of different places, started working in New York, and that's when the Canada basketball thing. And I was always like, well, if God doesn't want me to be in the NBA, he still wants me to be in basketball. And Canada basketball in 2011, it's like they knew all these kids, all these guys were coming. And they made investment. I didn't go for free. And just to see, all that has happened is like, this is like my family. Like, I remember being in a meeting once, and I'll say something else first. If you ask a lot of old heads in basketball, like old players that played in like the 70s and 80s, there's a line that a lot of them always use, like, what basketball has done for me. That's a thing that they say. And what basketball has done for me was we all had to say something that was, somewhat motivational in the front of all the staff and team. And I hope I don't do it right now. I broke down a little bit and I said, guys, y'all know that Canada is not my country, but it is my family. And to be there for 10 years, 11 years, and to still be credited with a lot of, the development of humans, not just basketball players, is very, very special. But then being on my own, because Canada basketball was like very segmented. It used to only be in the summer. Then it became like soccer, where it's four times a year. Then I got into other things. That's when you mentioned Nike. So again, okay. my buddy who was, we came up together in basketball. Mm-hmm. He was full-time in Nike. They offered me full-time, but I was already starting to roll a little bit in New York financially. Mm-hmm. So they gave me what still amounted to an entry-level salary to be a consultant, mm-hmm. where we did more basketball things. We got into every sport. So it's like, yeah, like I'm most known probably in basketball, but if somebody only heard of me over the last couple of years, they would think football, because that's more so than basketball.
Okay.
But I mean, I work with whatever. You know, mm-hmm. It's tennis. You mentioned tennis. So we went to Wimbledon with Milo. I worked with Milos Raonic for a whole year. And again, if you follow tennis now, not as big a name, but we finished second in Wimbledon. Nice. Golfers, you know, track, you know, it's not, I think there's a recognition that it doesn't matter really your sport, especially when you're that good. Mm-hmm. We just have to create solutions
right.
below that level of mm-hmm. technical level. So,
so with all your experience in all these sports, this conversation that we had actually right before the podcast was obviously extremely intriguing to me regarding like the PEDs and everything. So I guess out of interest, where did this experience and this knowledge come from?
Coming up in college, and I think a lot of us would say the same thing. There was always like somebody or like your crew, like, how did I not fucking think they were on steroids? I was always into training, and even coming up, like I felt like I had to train. But at that time, in the 90s, there wasn't, at least like athletic development was like power bodybuilding. Like you just train to get strong. Like, mm-hmm. and, when I left college and I didn't play baseball anymore, then I got into powerlifting because I was good at it. That was like my training and my sport. I got to, you know, some significant levels of powerlifting, but I was always clean, and that's fine. Like, I'm not saying that because the other choices would be bad, like the dark side or whatever. Like, no, yeah. this is the commitment it takes. Now, I also recognize that I was a strength coach in the NBA, so there's probably rules that I should be recognizing. But also, you're not really, there's no end game to competitive powerlifting. Like, there's no money.
Yeah.
So this is not really a thing. But then when you start to be around, because I did get to a level of where other names, like, this is serious. Like, I don't really follow competitive powerlifting now. Back then, it was like, when you followed it, it was like superheroes, like amazing things. And you start to learn what they were doing. I remember sitting across from my powerlifting mentor. It was a gentleman named Bill Crawford. He's the first mm-hmm. man to ever bench press 750 pounds.
Wow.
And now that's like nothing, you know, relatively. And because I was in minor league basketball in, where was it? Lake George, New York. And I just found lucky. Everywhere I went, there was always a gym you could handle, like, big weight. Even going back to high school, there was a Bally's Total Fitness, which would have been like the Jaclyn Lane gym. They had 100-pound wheels. Nobody cared if you used chalk. It was really blue. I always been very, very lucky. Everywhere throughout my, you know, adolescent to adult life, I always found a gym where you could handle weight, and it was acceptable. It wasn't like, you know, some school gym where it's a carpet and shit. Like, so Bill said, hey, if you stay here over the summer, we'll have you opening on the bench with 585, because that Adirondack Barbell would be known as like the bench. They would be a recognition that Bill taught the West Side guys how to bench with a shirt, not how to get strong, but how do you manipulate the shirt to get the most out of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, now that's where these stories of 200 plus pounds, like, you're not very strong at bench press. You're really good at using the shirt. Bill would have been the master of teaching that. And he says, I'm like, yeah, 585, that's pretty cool. Like, that'd be nice to finish the meet with that. And I've actually done that. But he's like, well, you know, right, that we take performance enhancing drugs. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of had my idea. Like, cause in powerlifting, nobody cares. I think, and look, there was no real social media, et cetera. Nowadays, obviously it's kind of, comedy, you know, when people say they do it or they don't do it, or like people make videos on whether somebody's on or not. Like, it's entertainment fodder. Like, I don't think anybody genuinely really cares. And if you do, that's cool too. But so that's where I started to learn some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same stuff that a bodybuilder, some of it, obviously there's overlap and the physiology doesn't change, but what are you trying to accomplish when you're a power lifter versus, not a power lifter or, bodybuilder, not even necessary. I would say this, a bodybuilder of a very, very high level stands next to a power lifter of a very, very high level. Most general public, man, a bodybuilder, like that's a jack, like that. And they're not nearly as strong as a power lifter.
Always,
because it's just not, you can't really do that.
Unless you're Larry Wheels.
Of course, that's it's very hard to accomplish many things in physical training.
Yeah. Real quick, guys. So while I was looking at the YouTube analytics, I actually saw that 85% of you guys that watch this channel are not subscribed. And I want to ask very little of you guys, but if you enjoy this podcast, if you find value in it, then please do me this one favor and subscribe to the channel, because doing so helps me get bigger and greater guests like the guests you are listening to today. Also, this channel is not sponsored, which means only the companies that I work with, which are Young Elaine Huge Supplements, are the companies that can help fund this channel by you guys using the code NILE. So code NILE gives you a discount of 15% off of Young LA, and code NILE also gives you a discount of 10% off of Huge Supplements. And if you decide to purchase anything from any of these companies, it will help immensely for me by using my code. And this way, I can travel to other guests such as Dr. Mike Israetel next week and also upgrade an equipment to make this podcast bigger and better for you guys.
So I always kind of knew that, and
also just like a little insert, but I did my, I got my DNA results. I put my 23andMe raw data into Prometheus, found out I have impaired muscle performance. So I'm more responsive to type 1 fibers and endurance rather than like power. So,
but hey, type 1, and this has a significant role, at least in my model of training athletes, type 1 muscles can, type 1 fibers can hypertrophy. And they hypertrophy with very, very less weight, meaning you don't have to pay as much. Mm. Now, part of that lower cost, AKA like soreness, recovery, et cetera, is that you're not going to get strong. But the value from an athletic development standpoint, which bodybuilders really understand by crook, not by hook, I'm sorry, by hook, like they don't know this. Mm-hmm. But because you train with a lot of time under tension with light weight. Mm-hmm. Well, so if you're using relatively lightweight, because relative is lightweight for one person is different than lightweight for another, and you train really, really slow, lightweight, slow, you're going to bias type 1 fibers. So if you put lots of time under tension and significant stretch, which maybe wouldn't be useful for an athlete, you not only will create hypertrophy of type 1 fibers, you'll also create hypertrophy of connective tissue should you put significant stretch on it. Type 1 fibers have mitochondria more than type 2. So now you're probably not going to help somebody punch harder in the eighth round, but they'll have some backup. More mitochondria in this case would equal more work capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So you're training. Like, you're not going to get explosive. You're not going to get strong. You're going to get super, you're going to add to your fitness. You potentially train for connective tissue, which is different than strength, and it's a hugely valuable tool. So, getting back to the PED piece, when you look at that, it doesn't mean you can't get jacked. Like nobody, like type 1 fibers don't look different than type 2 fibers. Uh-huh. When you're on stage or in a tight shirt. So now, for performance, you start to just get around and you talk, et cetera. And this is probably where I'll be a little bit more vague, is you learn and they're like, now I see how they can accomplish this thing. And then you start to learn, like, well, how do you not get popped on a test? Well, here's why. And I'm like, oh my God, like, wow, like this stuff is all like, it's the part of, how do you win? I was working with not an Avenger, an X-Men. Mm-hmm. So it was before they came together. So it was Fox, and he was in another movie because I knew of him as the X-Men character. and he was in a military movie. It was a Navy SEAL movie, and he was one of the four main characters. Okay, like we get. Am I laying enough out there? And he turns around to me because I don't know that he came to me because he knew I was at MARSOC, but he turns around. He's like, "So when you were at MARSOC, did you see a lot of tea?" And I'm like, "I don't even know what the fuck is tea. Like, I never even heard of it. They called that." Mm-hmm. And he's like testosterone, like drugs. I'm like, "Yo, man, like you're a Hollywood like celebrity. Like, you shouldn't need to ask me how to get that stuff. I'm not getting into this. Like, this is." And the answer was no, anyway. At least from what I saw. But I also would understand that for what a Marine Corps special operator does, it wouldn't necessarily be useful. Whereas other branches would be very useful for what they do in other forms of special operations. So you just start to understand physiology. And for instance, what makes you super, super strong, you know, and if you understand that and then the price you pay for that, then you understand like why they take a needle. So for instance, if you do, what is one of the best ways to improve hormones in a training environment? Lift heavy. Mm-hmm. The protocol that I would put at the top of lift heavy would be 4 to 8 repetitions to failure. So you have maximal, and this is evidence-based, but it's not the only way. And I'm not saying you should do it because 4 to 8 reps to failure, that means you need dudes to lift the bar off your chest. You better have you need to be somewhat of a high training age, you know, to get into that protocol. But from what I understand in the research, it's very, very efficacious. So why do you have to go to failure, and why does it have to be 4, not 3? You need to build up enough acidosis, hypoxia, swelling, edema, that you're done. Like you're mechanically and metabolically cooked. And those, particularly the acidosis, is the trigger to increase mass of endocrine glands. And bigger endocrine glands spit out more stuff. Whether it be your pancreas, which has value for that, whether it be your testicles, which have, that is not the only source of male testosterone, because we would use that protocol for women as well. Mm-hmm. 4 to 8 repetitions to failure. Now, think of like the 60s of like, yeah, you shouldn't only lift heavy, you have to do cardio as well. This is kind of where these legends, these stupid, you know, idiots that say these things, like squatting to 90 is bad for your meniscus. This all started from something viable. So when you have high levels of acidosis, it will decrease or compromise the efficiency or the volume of your mitochondria. So you run out of gas. It has nothing to do with your heart. But if your heart is getting blood to your muscles and you don't have mitochondria to use it, then you gas out. So acidosis is not exactly how it works, but acidosis beats up mitochondria. Okay, so that's the cost. So you have to do something, other type of training, to build back your mitochondria. Okay, that's cool. Like, I can do this to get strong, and I can do this for my endocrine goals, and I can do this for my peripheral mitochondria goals. How does this relate to PEDs? If you exogenously inject or take whatever for the hormone piece, you don't have to do the 4 to 8 repetitions to failure. If you don't have to do the 48 repetitions to failure, you don't have to do the mitochondria training. You can train something that's more focused, and you don't have to pay the same prices. I'll probably say that a lot. Like, when it comes to training, nothing's free. So when you start to understand that level of physiology, now I see why they do it. Because 48 repetitions to failure is a hard, I mean, it's miserable. Like, it's super hard. And that in itself, to people that just lift, no big deal. I want it to be hard. No, they got to practice their sport. They got to play in their games. So now that's one way to start to understand. Now I see why they do. Now I see why they do that. It's very different than bodybuilding or just generic lifting for sports. And that would probably fall into the anabolics, of which there's many. There's different types, et cetera. Many of which you can get at CVS. Like, these are not, it's not meant for high level athletes. It's meant for significantly diseased individuals that would benefit from this anibalism.
Right.
If you have AIDS or if you have burn victims.
Burn victims.
Burn victims is where the one is mostly. So those are the only stuff I really know about. I kind of know a little bit about the bodybuilding stuff, but I don't know because it's a different level. It's a different class. Like I remember Halo in powerlifting.
Of course.
Because I didn't know what it was. I just thought they were like, I didn't know there was something else there. Like you just get ramped up. And it's a good thing I didn't know what it was because I would have liked that. That would have been cool. But, so when you understand that piece of training for athletic development, well, what about human growth hormone? Does that human growth hormone is not the same as the 48 repetitions to failure. Human growth hormone would be stimulated by moderate levels or minimal levels of acidosis. So it's like a not the most demanding circuit you've ever done, but you knew you did something, but you did it the whole way. Like you took like, very reasonable rest periods and you just bounce around doing different things. That's for human growth hormone, which is different than the anabolics. Even though human growth hormone can be anabolic, it doesn't have to be. That's what we were talking about before, where if you don't eat and stimulate muscle tissue, the human growth hormone doesn't automatically just make you diesel. Mm-hmm. It accelerates all the other types of turnover and recovery process, which would be brilliant for an athlete that needs to constantly load their body with other things and doesn't have value to be big and strong. Mm-hmm. There's many sports, like a quarterback. You can be really, really great quarterback. You could be the greatest of all time and not be very strong or muscled because it's not what that activity, it doesn't make you better. Mm-hmm. So you would train differently for human growth hormone than you would. And then specifically with human growth hormone, well, like, that would probably be like the money move for professional athletes. And of course there's other types, they're all banned. It's all banned. The peptides pieces are banned, but you can only test for human growth hormone through blood. Mm-hmm. So ask a bunch of professional athletes hey, how often do they really test your blood? Like what? Like once a year. Like I'm not saying that's for every single person, but, mm-hmm. And plus no one really knows what is a normal amount of IGF-1.
Yeah. I was going to say there's a big range.
Exactly. So it could be circumstantial. So the first blood test you ever took showed IGF-1 of low end of whatever this assumed normal range is. Let's say it's 110, I think 80 would be the low end of a normal. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're going by the world here. Like for strong, athletic, healthy people, that number should be shifted to the right anyway. But let's say it's 100. And then all of a sudden you test and it's like 298. They might start asking questions and start getting tested more often, which is the purview of the leagues. Mm. So that's, but human growth hormone is the recovery. Like it's post-surgical. And the value point, because people would like, well, how can so-and-so be on steroids or PEDs? He's not XYZ. I'm like, because if you don't eat or train, then the human growth hormone doesn't make you look like, a monster. I have to make sure not to say names.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's another category, EPO, where in any repeat sprint sport, the better utilization that you have of oxygen, meaning you don't have to figuratively catch your breath as long, so you can go longer and maintain high level. And EPO doesn't make you diesel. When people ask these questions, not these questions, but like, but how can you? I'm like, hold on. Who is the most like storied, nefarious PED user in the history of elite sport? And sometimes people say Bonds or McGuire, and like, nah, keep going, keep going. I said the most. They're like, Lance Armstrong. Last time I checked, Lance Armstrong is going to blow away if you turn the air conditioning on too much. So you can take significant amounts of PEDs and not look like an IFBB pro. Mm-hmm. It's just there's different things that you would take to be a great athlete than to just be heavily muscled. Mm-hmm. So you've just been around long enough, but also understanding physiology and drugs, because these drugs exist to help other people. And that's, would I know that? I think I kind of would know that stuff even without my powerlifting experience, because, learning Soviet and Eastern European training, you know, because their training utilized those things significantly. Mm-hmm. And so they, these, you know, people that defected, et cetera, they would explain, you know, like, this is why you would take this, because this is the training. And now if you don't have to do all this training, you have more opportunities to use your biological resources to get good at your sport. That's the value point of where a high level athlete would take it. Mm-hmm. And then of course the, with all the money that is available, you know, guys and girls would make challenging decisions as their career comes to an end, where if you can make a little bit more money, I'm like, dude, these are not, I can't be a part of this. Like, I can't be, you know, when people ask, you know, and I'm not the biggest dude in the world, but people will, you know, see, and like, Charlie, you know about this stuff. I'm like, yeah, but I can't be involved in this. I can't be your, you know, you can find this from somewhere else. I don't get involved, because I can't be that guy, you know, like, yeah, that is known for this. I have a problem talking about physiology. Now if you're a civilian, meaning you're a CEO or whatever, maybe I'll be, you know, you have to bring it up. And, Charlie, like, what else can I really do? I said, what do you mean? What, you just got to train, eat, and sleep? Like, nah, like, I'm like, all right, listen, like, there's the junior program, there's a civilian program. I'm just giving you information that you have the opportunity to vet and look up. And I'm not the one giving to you, because the rule has to come from a physician. The physician has to monitor, you have to have blood work. It's almost self-regulating. Now, I can't make a physician do something. And that's where it gets fuzzy, because if you find that physician who has a different risk profile, he or she is the one on the hook. If you have something legally, you're good. Forget about your health risks. Yeah, that's probably debatable that there isn't even a health risk if you're taking the right things in the right amounts. Mm-hmm. But if a physician is accused of writing a prescription for something that's not medically necessary, they're the ones that are going to fry. Mm-hmm. That's how probably in certain sports where there were no rules, like in baseball, there were no rules until 2006. In WWE, there were no rules, you know, for a significant period of time. If you found a guy that did it, and in certain states, you know, it's easy, like where it's a little bit more wild, wild west, then it would be very accessible. And that's no commentary on the health risks or the physiology. It's just more of, you know, how does this happen? Like how, because it's, people will figure out ways to make money and win. And, you know, it's, I'm not even saying if you can't beat them, join them. I do think there's a responsibility to understand, okay, why are we even doing this? Like, does it work? Like, does it do things? And then, you know, there's at the athlete level, the risk profile of what is being pushed or recommended is not nearly the risk profile of even recreational, you know, bodybuilders down the street. Like these are two completely different worlds, two completely different worlds.
For sure. So what are the like training programs and modalities for mitochondria?
So, I would put mitochondria as like the, like if we put up a slide right now, the mitochondria is, that is the goal of what I call peripheral cardiovascular adaptations. Let me take a step back, because there's two, like there's central and there's peripheral. So if you do a maximal fitness test and you're going to go until you drop, I'm going to be like, nah, why'd you stop? You're going to tell me one of two things. You're going to tell me nothing. Hold on. Okay. So that means you can't get any more air. Like you're cooked. Your CO2, all this is your heart and lungs that were the limiting factor at that point. Sometimes Niall does a different test or a different day, and he says that, you know, I'm surprisingly feel like I'm good, but my legs feel like they're just going to die, like they're waterlogged. Like I can't lift my foot up. My calf feels like it's screaming. That's peripheral. Okay. So that we would suggest that the limiting factor is more mitochondria, where in that second situation, you demonstrated that you could get blood to the area because you kept getting air and your heart kept working, but you had to stop. It couldn't have been, they have to be different. They're too, and that's reasonable, right? There's no different, there's no reason it can't be one or the other. It can't be both. Like that won't happen. So now how do we train to put mitochondria in these working muscles? There's three protocols, one of which is the bodybuilding protocol that we just talked about a little bit before. The one of the most researched, it would be known in the Eastern Bloc training as statodynamic. Okay, not to be confused with dynamic overcoming static that you would see in conjugate that Louis always talked about, like off the box. Stato-dynamic, that's what it's called. But it's also known as oxidative training, or tempo training. Not running, but meaning you're on the clock. So you have a metronome and you're going to do one of the favorites that I would use, I call 2-0-2-0, where you're let's say you're back squatting, 2 seconds down, zero, meaning there's immediate reversal. If it's an athlete, I don't care if they go to parallel. Doesn't matter to me. That's not what we're trying to do. 2-0-2-0, 2 seconds up, and then quickly, like you don't stop. You never stop because you're trying to build that acidosis and edema because that is also a hormonal protocol. But if I'm only going to use maximum 50% of 1 RM, and we're going to do as many as 10 reps. So this is very, very light, super light. And if anybody thinks that like, that's nothing, wait until maybe, especially if you're fit, the second set, rep 7, you'll be making some noise. Like this is savage, like how you feel like in that type of squatting. And I would when I've used that protocol, I go to full depth or 90 degrees or whatever. You're screaming because now you're using lightweight, very, very slow for very long, relatively long periods of time. So 40 seconds is our 10 reps. You would start that protocol with 1 minute rest. You got to answer the bell. You could get it lower. The lower, the better. That means you can, but can you answer the bell? Can you actually come back into the rack and take the bar out? And can you get all 10 reps? So you don't ever change the weight until you can dominate that. Okay. That is type 1 fiber hypertrophy. And type 1 fibers have mitochondria. So even if you're an explosive or strength athlete, that mitochondria supports. It's not like just because you do something explosive doesn't mean your type 1 fibers just sit there. It's not like they don't contract. Mm-hmm. I think there's a unfortunate, very low-level thought process that like muscles are type 1 or type 2. No, fibers are type 1 or type 2. So some muscles are predominantly type 2 just based on what they are and what they're meant to do. Mm-hmm. But it's not like there's no type 1s. So the type 1s work. So if later in your fatigue state, you have more mitochondria in the muscle itself, because the type 1 fibers are there, you will increase your work capacity. So I don't know if that protocol takes your bench from, 3 wheels to 3.5, but you'll get more quality reps at your 3 wheels, meaning you get stronger because you have more work capacity at that level. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two is now type 2 fibers in the myofibrils themselves, okay? So we're going to put mitochondria into the muscle fibers. Now, that is, you put more stuff into the muscle, it gets bigger. So you're going to see, when you see soccer players or cyclists, they have like these ridiculous quads. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not training the same way as bodybuilders. Mm-hmm. But what they are doing is going for very, very long periods of time. Okay. Very, very long periods of time with sort of heavy weight. So they're not riding the bike like down the street. They have that crank on where they're like doing 20 to 30 revolutions per minute because they have no choice. Like their maximum effort is like, when from my powerlifting background, when you would hear of West Side guys, we would take that sled and we would just walk up and down in the parking lot, a total of a mile. So that's a more rudimentary protocol of type 2 myofibril mitochondrial biogenesis. But that's what they're doing. They're going for a long period of time with weight. So probably not enough weight to make you strong, mm-hmm. but enough weight to stimulate this mitochondrial biogenesis in the muscle fibers. That one, again, it sounds like bodybuilding. Like you're now that one you kind of have to go for at least 20 minutes. Mm. And I think most people that are not well trained in that adaptation, you have to chunk up that 20 minutes. You have to like interval it because you just can't keep going. Mm-hmm. 20 So if there was I told a story in hockey, riding a bike after the game is like culture. And in Philly, the 76ers and the Flyers, we would share the same weight room. It was like their locker room was over here, ours was over here. And of course, basketball is a much different culture of preparation. So the guys would be like, yo, Chuck Wagon, why these bikes got this stupid dial, man? Like, I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, just use it. I know now. Cause it was like you would set the RPMs. It was almost like the bike was on a fixed resistance. You could do 20, you could do 40, you could do 60, or you could do 120. So it's kind of like this isokinetic, like the speed of the bike was like shit gears, like on a regular road bike. And then like you would put it at 20 just to see what it feel like. It's like you're pushing weights. To do that for 20 minutes straight, you're going to have big giant quads, particularly if you're using a bike. And you could do any exercise. As I described, the sled is a little bit less specific to those parameters that the literature would support. Mm-hmm. But now you have mitochondria in your muscles, type 2. That's how you again, you're probably not going to get stronger in your numbers, but you'll get stronger in your numbers because you can train more. That's work capacity. Work capacity is like very specific to what you're trying to do. So I don't know what work capacity is. Like work capacity for what? Okay. Does this what? Would that benefit from more mitochondria in your quads? Let's get on that bike. Let's do the rower. And row, you know, when I have a gentleman who's trying to make the Olympics in one of the individual rowing, I don't know the names of it. And he's got giant quads. And then he's like, I think they call it like cycle 3 or something. I said, what's that? He's like, oh, that's where we set the resistance really, really high. And we just try to go as long. I'm like, oh my God, that's awesome. Cause you see, it's like, it's kind of easy-ish for someone who's highly trained. Mm-hmm. So it becomes recovery. Because if you're training your ass off to get strong and explosive, you're spending mitochondria. Like they denature. So you have to build it back with these other protocols. So that's two different ways. So we have now lightweight, slow. Okay. You have fairly heavyweight, slow. Okay. Now we have lightweight, fast. Okay. That's type 2 sarcoplasm. So if my fingers are the muscles, you see how they can contract. Mm-hmm. But this is all part of the muscle. Inside here, inside here, inside here. That's the sarcoplasm.
That thickens.
It doesn't necessarily thicken. It can. Mm-hmm. But I'm commenting on it because there's mitochondria there too. Mm. So it's different than the mitochondria in the muscle. That's the why do we want mitochondria outside the muscle? Because if you are a repeat moving athlete, meaning you start and stop, which includes sprinting, like there's this turnover. Part of that muscle contraction and then relaxation involves calcium. Calcium has to get in and out of the cell. If it doesn't do that, you can get rigor, meaning like you create this spasm, or you just don't contract. So if I have more work capacity where the calcium has to get in and out of the cell, aka mitochondria, then I have high value for, again, work capacity for a sprinter. So we would use maybe 20 to 30% of your body weight to do kettlebell swings done correctly, like, you know, normal, not over your head. And like, where you don't want, no one comes near you. You are swinging because it's light. It's like you have to swing this kettlebell at like a sprint pace and no one goes near you. Like if you drop the thing, like you would break every window in the gym. 5 repetitions every 30 seconds. Oh, that doesn't sound like any. The beginner protocol is 5 repetitions for a minute. That's like boring. Yeah, pretty much. But by the time you're done with 7 or 8 rounds, you'll realize like, okay, I understand what we're doing here. So you have now this very significant rest period. So you can be a super explosive and your form is on point and you're just dialed in because you're not fatigued. That's how you can stimulate mitochondria in the sarcoplasm. So depending on what you're trying to accomplish, you have 3 protocols, all for the peripheral cardiovascular, which was your question, like what can we do to gain mitochondria? Now, those are mainly deliverables for the athletes that I would work with, like repeat sprint, explosive type athletes. Of course, there's many, many other protocols that would probably not be as focused as the 3 that I described. But if you just go out for, or if you're just on the rower or the elliptical or something, you go relatively like medium hard, you know, zone two, a little zone three. If I don't really talk about those things, but I'm sure that people can identify what they are. Mm-hmm. 4 minutes on, 2 minutes easy. That all of these things, anything you do like relatively challenging for a long period of time, you're kind of dividing it all up. It's not as focal as I just described to those three.
Gotcha.
But you can work on central and peripheral at the same time, and it's not very, very specific. So when I use those three, which I champion very much, I do not want someone to think like that's not the only way to build mitochondria. Right. My bias of who I work with, those three are crucial. But that's not the only way.
Gotcha. But it sounds like, I mean, I might just be making like assumptions and connections based off of like, this could be totally wrong, but it kind of reminds me of like daily undulating periodization where like someone's focusing on like a power on one day and then say like hypertrophy on the next day. And the purpose is like they're splitting up the training regimens with like vastly different rep ranges. Just for the purpose of like such specification.
You're not wrong. So I think that the piece that you're trying to grab onto, this is what I'm interpreting, is that you realize that you have to, just because you're recovering from one training session's goal, like the stress of that training mm-hmm. session, you can't do it again until you're recovered from it.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't do something else.
Yeah.
If that's what you're trying to say, then you're 100% correct.
Yeah.
I don't know that we would need a daily undulating approach to all these things because I just gave you three protocols. Depending on how we were training someone, you just kind of understand the science of the different protocols and then you pick and choose. So how long would it take to get out of this one? And how long would it take to get out of this one? And then, so I'll do this one to replace what I had to pay for from that one. So I look at the training process for someone that's very, very advanced. There's like primary factors. So I would say any human being that does something physical, bodybuilding, basketball, construction worker, anybody, if they have exceedingly high levels or ideal levels of hormones, immune cells, particularly T cells, and then the two cardiovascular components, you win. Like those, that's your monster. But then how they express those qualities. Strength, hypertrophy, power, that's the secondary qualities. But how do you, because then you can tailor that work capacity of those top four into, you know, the secondary goal. So like for bodybuilding, I would say, okay, this is your show. This is what you're gearing up for. Okay. I don't know how to do that. I don't, it's not my skill set. How long do you need? Like under normal circumstances, if you were going to compete in a bodybuilding show now, how long would you start and finish your training? Is it 4 months? I don't know. What is it?
Like prep?
Yeah. Okay. Whatever the word is. Yeah. I don't even know. Okay.
Like prep for like being in a calorie deficit to get leaner, probably maybe like 16 weeks, maybe 12.
Okay. So 12 to 16 weeks. I'm not commenting on it. I need another 12 to 16 weeks to do this other thing so that when you start your 12 to 16 weeks, you will get more quality reps, more quality sets, more quality microcycles, however you build that out. Because mm-hmm. that's like training for the sport, which mm-hmm. I don't have any experience. I do know that if I can understand more of everything that you're doing, and I understand a little bit, but I don't know the specifics. I'm not proper to comment. I know if I take some of those things and then put them into hormones, T cells, central cardio and peripheral cardio, you'll have more work capacity for your 16 weeks. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's because I consider your 16 weeks like you're practicing for your sport. Mm-hmm. And it makes this different because this is there's no motor, well, aside from posing, there's no like motor skill.
Right.
Like so it definitely changes something there whereas there's no like, which is kind of good though in a way where my training just has to accomplish this internal goal. I don't have to translate it into movement. Mm-hmm. That to me makes it a little bit easier because there's a whole set of rules on how you get strong, how you get fast, how you have good hormones and all that stuff. There's a whole nother set of the rules on how you learn how to move. Like how do you learn how to hit a baseball? How mm-hmm. do you learn how to do a skill? And that has to be bundled in to the whole athletic development process.
Gotcha.
But you see like the what bodybuilders, again, by hook or by crook, they're good at, these models work because they're based in science and we just use them in a little different way. You know, long eccentrics, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. it's, now, for instance, or what I think over the last maybe 14, it's a little over a year to my knowledge, that very deep stretch is very, very significant for hypertrophy. Okay. I would be interested in the next step of understanding that is, so this thing is bigger. Okay. It measures bigger. Is the connective tissue more hypertrophied or is the contractile elements more? My guess is that it's connective tissue, mm-hmm. Because that would be very, very consistent with what we know how to train, muscle tears and tendon injuries, et cetera, et cetera. It's always long. When you make the tissue long, that's the signal to, if you can make the tissue long and hold it with enough active tension, mm-hmm. passive, it's not like passive doesn't count, but in order to create collagen in series, like to make it like long, and then challenge the direction of it, you need like some level of hypoxia. That's why, like in martial arts, like you hold these stretches really, really hard. And then all of a sudden this changes because the hypoxia creates, but that's collagen, elastin, titan. You know, it's like a gymnast who couldn't lift their way out of a paper bag, but they're jacked because they're not strong. They have connected. It's a different version of strong, or like MMA or like wrestlers, you know, they're not strong. They're also some of the, you know, weirdest looking lifters that you've ever seen. But they have incredible connective tissue. There's probably insensitive ways to describe that type of strength. That you just can't move them, but they can't move weight because it's not what's useful for them. So when you're in all these jacked up, like huge, long positions, my gut is that the stimulus is more towards connective tissue hypertrophy, which is not, in my mind, not the same as contractile element. Mm-hmm. Hypertrophy. So again, it's all there. Like it's just, what is your, like we're all using the same ingredients, but we have a different recipe because we want the cake to come out a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And that includes training on machines, which would be like the pariah, you know, for, you know, certain athletic development approaches. You know, like I don't think my quad knows how the mitochondria got in there. Mm-hmm. And if doing a bunch of leg extensions negatively affects your squat, then you're a bad coach. Like that shouldn't have happened. Now, I don't think old people that have never trained before should only be shown on machines. You have to teach them, you know, ideal ways to move their body. Them getting big, strong muscles isn't going to, you know, overcome their challenges of falling. They might even fall harder. So everything has a role and a place to a degree.
Right.
And mitochondria is a huge, huge value point in that started this whole thread.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. My struggle point, I guess, is like, especially if I'm trying to, I guess, strengthen my knees. It's always like, am I putting too much weight? It's always my concern. So,
I mean, if you're strengthening your knees, I'd want to know more of what are we trying to do here? Cause you can strengthen your quad and patellar tendon. And that would be a very different way than you would strengthen the connective tissue of the entire system. When we talk about the knee, you know, is hip extension involved in this? Because typically knee rehab happens, you know, in a leg extension machine because you're focusing on the tendons. Well, if I flex my hip, I slack out my quad. So where's the leg extension machine with hip extension?
Hip extension, exactly.
Yeah, like it doesn't, like there's a way to rig it, but then that's a completely different system that's being stimulated.
Uh-huh. But that one's more optimal for the knee.
That's why I'm saying like both, everything that I just said probably would result in some form of, you would feel like your knee is more X, like strong, stable, whatever word that you want it to be.
Would technically hip extension also, like that would also like contribute to your full stretch if you're just trying to grow the connective tissue as well,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
So that's where rear foot elevated split squats. Mm-hmm. So obviously if you do rear foot elevated split squat or something like that, you should be putting more weight on the front leg. So that has a whole set of value as to, you know, if you can back squat, you know, I'll just say 400 pounds, in theory, you should do 200 on one leg, 200 on the other leg, in theory. Except what the cool part is that you could do like 250 and 250. That's called the bilateral deficit. I'm fudging the numbers, mm-hmm. but you can do more. If you add up your right and left, you can do more. So now, especially if it's bodybuilding, I'm pretty sure your muscles don't know what exercises you're doing as long as you're stimulating the pattern. Because if you erase my body and I'm doing a correct rear foot elevated, you don't know what I'm doing. You don't know what the rest of my body's doing. It looks like I'm squatting. So that's, but now the extra value is that when you put some tension, I don't know the numbers, maybe 80-20, 70-30, like there's something happening at the backside that you're asking about. So now if it's super, super stretched and it doesn't move, that's the exact way to have a connective tissue value, particularly of the tendons.
Okay.
Cool. So that's, you know, I got into the bilateral deficit with might tweak some people, but that's, yeah, there's room for everything. Your muscles don't, that one I stand on my head. Your muscles do not know what exercises they're doing. When you're only training for an internal response, like putting, like, my friend, his name is Eric Otter. He works for the Memphis Grizzlies. Years ago, before he was in the NBA, he's like, well, the organelles, like the mitochondria, they have to get into the muscle somehow. So if I run the protocol of leg extension and squats, mm-hmm. the same thing happens. Now, I may not be able to access all of my mitochondria that I generate from knee extension in my squat because there's a motor skill difference. But squats versus rear foot elevated, and I don't get hurt as much because I'm using literally half the weight. There's some value there, but you'll still get what you want. Like but it's okay to squat. I squatted 800 pounds. I unracked 936. So everything's cool.
That's crazy.
Everything's cool. Like I'm not against back squat.
Yeah. If you feel like any of the medications that we spoke about today may benefit you, such as BPC-157, GH secretagogues such as tesamorelin, IGF-1, oxandrolone trochet, semaglutide, then you can obtain these from Transcend HRT, and the link for that will be in the bio. If you feel like you're experiencing symptoms of low testosterone, such as depression, anxiety, lack of motivation, as well as lack of sex drive, then you can get this checked out as well by getting your blood work done at Transcend, and they will provide you expert medical analysis. Transcend HRT has worked with many professional bodybuilders and pro athletes, such as Thor Bjornsson, Phil Heath, and Jeremy Buendia. And if you feel like this podcast has any relevancy to you, I do believe that this clinic will provide of great benefit to you as well.
I think I said I squatted 800 pounds.
Oh yeah, dude, that's crazy. What were your numbers when you were powerlifting?
The biggest meet I think was 1930, which at that time, you know, was whatever. But I had a bigger training deadlift and a training squat. So I think I don't even know if I'm supposed to say this, but obviously I squatted 800. That was for real. I was good at that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm built for squatting. My legs are like really long, believe it or not.
Wait, do you think the long legs do long?
No. So if people can't tell, I'm like 5'4" Okay. Mm-hmm. I can stand next to, I've stood next to a dude, the tallest that he was my last XO. He's 6'2" and mm-hmm. my legs are longer. Okay. It's not necessarily long legs are good for squatting. Mm-hmm. It's that the short torso.
Yeah.
And then I have, I don't know how big my head is. Cause then again, like if you're dealing with basketball players, I don't, like you could be 7'1", but your head is like 2 feet. Like it's not useful.
Right.
Now, of my long legs, I have very short femurs. So that means when I sit back, my center of mass is still closer to still closer to my base of support. So I've studied this, and we've done this at Nike, like where you look at the value points of mm-hmm. neighboring lengths. Mm-hmm. So you always want to be taller. You always want to have long legs. You always want a bigger hand, bigger foot. But then how is that made up? There is an advantage. And then different sports have different advantages. Mm-hmm. So for instance, my size and my anthropometry is very, very good for squatting. I'd be terrible at rowing because I'm short. And when I'm sitting down, I'm even less tall. Mm-hmm. So then when you look at a rower, they would have actually longer legs and a taller torso. So that when they sit back, they have more torque because they're longer.
Gotcha.
Like you want your, you always want a big hand, but you want your fingers longer than your hand. You want your toes longer than your foot. So that, because that's what moves. So you have a longer lever to create force.
Gotcha.
And then the part that you have to control is smaller. It's like, it's way easier to control a ruler than a yardstick.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It doesn't mean you can't be good at a sport.
Less torque.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I've benched 595 in a shirt and I pulled 675. Unfortunately, I couldn't do it all in the same day.
Damn, that's crazy.
The cool thing that,
so your squat was higher than your pull.
Yeah.
Well, damn, that's crazy.
But again, in the style that I would, remember too, no matter how you cut it, I have big shoulders. The bar sits on me. My grip can only be so much. I'm sounding like a bitch, but like I didn't have a strong grip, so I couldn't pull a lot that maybe my legs could.
I see.
Someone who would know in Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. they said that I'm only one of two people that they knew of at a high level that squatted 800 clean, meaning, wow, I never took anything at that time. And the other person was about 150 pounds heavier than me. And then I said, well, what do you think of, like, what if I told you that I only had a size 7 foot? They're like, what? So the reality is, like, 5'4", you still have like a size 9, you know, size 10 maybe. I have size 7 feet. So think of any lower body activity. I have the smallest, like, base of the, mm-hmm, of the system. So think about, like, squatting is a little bit back and forth, mm-hmm, at least the way I squatted, which was sit back. Mm-hmm. You only have this much foot versus somebody else has this much foot. You have more leeway to balance your body. So I would be very aggrandizing to that. And at that time, the best, because everything, remember too, I'm talking about equipped, mm-hmm, powerlifting, which I don't even know if is still a thing. Unlimited ply was where I, you know, where I competed. That was the best, and that's what I wanted to do. And at that time, the gear, the brand was called Metal, and I think it's still a brand. And you would, their best, their thickest stuff was called Ace. So I had Ace briefs. So those were the best briefs you could get. But the guys I was competing against, they had Ace squatter suits. So they had 4-ply. I wore a single ply Metal suit, like that you would use in a different federation, because that's what I had first. So I did that with 3-ply, size 7 feet clean, and it just doesn't matter. Like, at some point in powerlifting, there's always going to be somebody stronger than you. And, you know, I look up, I have this most significant respect for the guys that, because I didn't make the commitment that they made. Like, mm-hmm, I was a bitch. If that's what, you know, yes, I did it. Like, I was also in the NBA, and I'm pretty sure the end game of powerlifting wasn't really going to happen. Mm-hmm. The other guys did other things. Their whole life was like based around training. Mine was not. There would be times like 2 weeks at a time I didn't train.
Yeah.
So,
bro, I think having an 800-pound squat is enough.
nobody's going to take that away from me. I think the legend is, this is now several years, but it was the 20th best squat in certain list, and then I fell off. Like, it was so. But no, it was always. I'm most, even though we're all kind of, you know, the same age, if you will. When the West Side guys, like, yeah, we knew, you know, and you had a great looking, like, they respect, you know, what I did. Mm-hmm. And that to me is cool. Cause even though you're same age, being so small, like from a height, you do look up, literally and figuratively look up to people. Like, whether you're,
yeah.
So I looked up to those guys. I always wanted to do that. Like, I feel like a little kid even saying it. And now some of these guys are my friends. Mm-hmm. And the guys that, like, and they'll poke me, because there was a bunch of names in the 181, 198 category, and I would have smashed them, but I didn't make the same commitment, and I was a bitch. Like, so it's okay. Like, I'm not, but I can say that. Like, I didn't take anything, and I didn't dedicate my training the same way that that they did. So, mm-hmm, but they get mad because it's almost like you didn't want to pledge the fraternity kind of thing.
Gotcha.
And that's okay because it's a cool, like, hey, when guys in the locker room don't fuck with each other, that means they hate you. So like it's okay to get, I'm allowed to get picked on because what they're saying is actually true. And I would also say to the end of time, if I took even baby steroids at that time and or trained in 4-ply, easily would have gone for a grand at 198, easily, because other guys were doing it. So like I don't think I could do it anymore if I ramped it up, but that's okay. Like I know there's no way I couldn't, there's no way I wasn't gonna. I mean, there was one meet where I had 900 planned and I've unracked, I got buried, but I unracked over 900. So yeah, I love powerlifting. I miss it when you talk about it like this. It's, yeah. And it was you learned that's not how everybody should train. That was like in the 80s and 90s where, oh, just put more horsepower into the engine and everything will be cool. Nah, like that's, because I would get pinned on that, like meaning I'd have to overcompensate to not train people the way I trained myself. Like that's wrong. Like that's, but a lot of coaches are like that. Like they believe what they believe and they're going to train everybody in what they like to train.
Right.
Whether of whatever their preferred space is, like bodybuilding, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, everything. I just train people by the science, and the lifts are just vehicles. They're all just cars like out in the street. It doesn't matter. They all get us from A to B. Yep. Clearly it's a nicer ride in one versus the other. That's a deeper understanding of your exercise selection.
Reeling it back just a little bit. So what are the differences in like PEDs that you've seen across the sports, aside from like, I think you did mention the growth hormone with something, for example, such as football.
Human growth hormone doesn't know what sport you're playing.
Right. I probably didn't refer to like your example before the podcast when you're stating like a football player that performs like he's like 25, but he's actually like 45 or something.
Yeah. So that would be and one that is not heavily muscled. Mm. That's exactly what they would be taking to accomplish that. And it's also the easiest one to not test for, which I think we did discuss a little bit.
Yeah.
Meaning you have to measure it in blood and you don't even really know. Now, human growth hormone and IGF-1 are obviously two different things, but you're measuring IGF-1 on traditional blood work. So, and it would be really circumstantial. But obviously, if someone, I don't know what the upward number of IGF-1 would be, but if it's like well over 300, all right, so this is a wild, number. Yeah, I never heard of such a thing. But I would describe it, and I'll try to describe it in like a cartoony way. So if anybody challenges my understanding of the physiology, just I'll explain it another way if you like. But let's say you and I were completely different human beings 60 days ago. Every cell in our body changed over. Like it's like our skin, our heart, every cell is different. There's this constant turnover of cells. Like it's just what we are. If we took time lapsed, it would look like, it's like the snap. Like when Thanos hit the snap, we kind of become this, sand, and then it comes right back. That's what's happening in the body. So if there's systems in the body that are happening, and it's related to your training or your rehabilitation of an injury, your body is properly stimulated to turn over. So that's why you train certain ways to take advantage of that. My understanding is that human growth hormone just accelerates what's already happening in your body. So if the tendon turns over from this very, very effective evidence-based tendon approach, and it turns over once in a day, I'm making up like cartoony numbers, you take human growth hormone, it turns over 5 times in a day, meaning it got better faster. It didn't get better. It got better faster. And the good news when it comes to injury, my understanding is that the tendon is in. Whereas when you're talking about strength and power or other types of things, of other types of performance enhancing drugs, once you stop taking it, you cannot maintain that stimulus and you start to lose it. But when it's with the connective tissue, it actually stays that way because it's like the thing. It's like this support beam in your home. Like it's built up. It does not require more stimulus to continue to stay there, whereas other tissues do. So now, if you don't, like we were saying, if you're a American football player that does not value or require certain muscle size, muscle strength, explosiveness, you just want to stay healthy and be able to be who you are as often as you possibly can. That's exactly what you would take. It's like weird to me that no one, this one I'll be happy to discuss because I don't know. I did a podcast with a former NFL player and he wanted to ask a lot about Aaron Rodgers' Achilles, you know, injury. And we mm-hmm. talked about it. It's like, I know his surgeon here. It's all very sensible. Like everything makes sense.
Yeah.
Then I said, like, there's a couple things that we don't know. Like, we don't know. We only know what we see on SportsCenter. I didn't see him doing box jumps. I didn't see him doing, like, hard stops. Like, he's not doing anything that would be that weird, like, to me on this type of protocol. That's number one. Even though he was, like a month and a half ahead of the protocol that's for that type of surgery that not everybody gets. I'm like, all right, well, that's interesting. The other thing is he had it on his front foot. So right-handed thrower, your back foot would be more jeopardized as you sit back onto your backside.
Right.
He didn't have, he had it on his front. Okay, so that allows this accelerated approach of what we're seeing. But then the third thing I said that, you know, I thought was interesting, I don't know how in the world no one is bringing up human growth hormone. Because if someone has a surgery, a connective tissue surgery or injury, and it gets better really, really fast, the exact thing you would be doing is human growth hormone. Yeah. And no one says it. They want to talk about this guy and this guy. And then I went on the podcast, the same I'm saying right now, because I just believe in the truth. I have nothing to do with it. I'm just saying it's strange and no one has brought this up. And I said, well, 2 years ago, this same individual stood in front of the United States and said that he figuratively said he didn't have to go by the rules, meaning he didn't get the COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. He said he got inoculated. The moment I heard him say he got inoculated, he's like, I never said I was vaccinated. That's why he chose that word, because that's the kind of guy he is. So if somebody gave you one episode of their saying, I don't have to play by the rules, why would you think he wouldn't do it again? Yeah, like now, if he never said that, you have less. My voice is not as loud, but that would be, you know, it's a recover.
Yeah.
So like the stimulus is already in all that edema, all that acidosis, and then you apply proper loading, no differently than if you want your tendons, like you say, you want your knees stronger. If it's about the tendon, it's the exact same process. Your entry point for a torn thing that is no longer torn, you just have to start a little bit to the left and be much more precise. Like you can't be that mean with it, because if it tears again, then it's all hell. So think of going back what I'm saying. If that tendon is going to turn over figuratively once a day, human growth hormone will have it turn over 5 times a day and you'll get better faster. That's my understanding. And that's where we can say, yes, human growth hormone is anabolic. It doesn't fit into the testosterone categories of, what is it, like test base, 19-NOR, and DHT. Mm-hmm. See, everybody listening, I know what I'm talking about. So it's not that human growth hormone is not in, it's not in that category, because they're just different things. Mm-hmm. But human growth, but of course, there's the one study where you load up, you sit on this couch, and you do get bigger. Like, the very little, but like that can, like the nitrogen retention of those substances, you know, can happen with minimal training. You're not going to, no one's doing it for that reason. Mm-hmm. But those things, you know, they do something very unique that human growth hormone, my understanding, doesn't do. Mm-hmm. So yep. If you don't eat or train with a particular loading scheme, then you don't get bigger. So if all you trained was Olympic lifting, where you were explosive all the time, that is, it's not zero, but that is not a premier protocol for hypertrophy. That's just because it's not what it is. Mm-hmm. Human growth hormone with that will help you be more explosive and handle more weight, but you're not going to get bigger because the protocol isn't getting bigger.
Yep.
It gets you good at what you're doing. And that's a, yeah, but that's, again, I will suffix if it's against the rules of your sport, you shouldn't be doing it. Like it's and if it's against the rules of your workplace or whatever, like I have to say those things.
What are your thoughts about BBC 157?
Very
with like especially potentially with Aaron Rodgers.
Oh, it's not going to. No, actually, not useful. I'm sorry, I cut you off. My understanding of the literature is that BPC after a significant injury is useless. You're pissing in the ocean. So little baby injuries, useful.
Yeah.
Prophylactically with no injuries, very, very useful. The your disc is 3 inches out of the intervertebral space. BPC ain't doing shit. That's that's
even yeah. Even with like inflammation from post surgery,
no
recovery,
no. My understanding of the evidence of BPC is that once there's already a significant injury, it's not powerful enough to dent it. It's not that it doesn't. Like, I would say everything works 100% of the time. Is that does it work in the context of how you're using it?
Okay.
So no, it would not. I would not BPC post surgical. Is not something that I would get excited about. If somebody insisted on doing it, that's fine. I think you also need to be very, very cautious of where you're injecting post-surgically, because if that's the angle we're going to go down here. I believe that your little insulin needle is totally above board and safe, et cetera. But any pathology that is put near the surgical site and running the risk of sepsis is completely out of line. Like you should be injecting far away from your Achilles if that's what you're going to do, because it's not worth it. Like even for acupuncture and dry needling, you would do it far away from the surgical site. Just because even though everything's clean and you have gloves, all this, it is not even remotely worth it to gain that little bit of effort when there's other methods that I think you can use.
Okay. Gotcha. What about peptides and other PEDs? With sports and I guess potential testing.
So for instance, in different sports leagues, there's their policy of revealing what you got hit for is different. So in the NFL, they don't tell you what the player did. DeAndre Hopkins is a very big time wide receiver. He did share what he was popped for. That doesn't mean he took it, but. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else you would get popped for it.
Right.
And I don't know all the different names of like the letters and the name, but he got popped for Osterine, which would be, am I correct that it's a SARM?
Considered.
Okay. See, like is a SARM a peptide? I don't know because I don't know enough, but I do know, I know what a SARM is. I know what it does. And I know, yes, that would be of use. I don't know DeAndre Hopkins. I do know that what probably happened was he took something from someone or something that he trusted, because there's no way a player at that level would knowingly do this. And he had such a mild level that, because he shared it, like he volunteered it. Other players that have been popped in the NFL don't share it. BPC is banned. I don't know how they measure for it. CJC is banned. Everything is banned. CJC. Ibutamorin, I think Tristan just got hit for. Tristan Thompson would be one of my guys. Ipamorelin would be a major like Olympic sport. You see that a lot, like get popped. Now, if you get popped for one of the anabolics, you're a doofus. Like you're just a douchebag. Like, because you know, exogenous. You know, testosterone, DHT, 19, you can't hide. I remember somebody showed me, like, this person says that they're not taking anything. I said, they're lying. Like, this is, you know, the HPA axis is a factor in this. So I think if you look at the list, sometimes you'll see nandrolone or testosterone or the things that have value for an athlete, but you don't see them as much because it's just dumb. It's just, it's just stupid because you can't, I don't know how to hide from those things. There are some that I'm hearing that you can hide, but they're not names that you typically would hear of. There's one that has a 2-hour half-life. So don't take it after 4 a.m. because WAD ain't coming earlier than 6. You know? But all of those things, like again, human growth hormone would be the one, and EPO, because they don't make you look big, because that's like the that puts the target on your back.
Yeah.
And again, I'm very comfortable that I'm not saying anything that only I would know. Like, I'm saying all information that a little bit of opinion, clearly, but mainly, you know, because look, I know doctors that do certain things, and you know, being from Toronto, for 10 years, 2 to 3 months out of the year, I'm from Toronto. That Toronto is track town USA, not Eugene, Oregon. And, you know, that's where, you know, Germany was a place where a lot of injections, you know, because it was out of the country, people had less eyes on it. And sometimes superstars got popped, but because the media outlet wasn't American, then nobody believed it. It just went away. So, because to do different types of injections that have other stuff in it, that's a very powerful tool to help people overcome injuries. It's very, I think when you're someone that doesn't get tested, I think the utility of them all being safe and proper to be in the same syringe, CJC, BPC, and TB500, they can all be in the same, I call it a plunger.
Yeah.
That's the junior program. That's that can be very, very useful for people. 100%. Even pre or post surgical. The BPC probably isn't doing that much, but again, when you're part of how you would dominate any type of surgery, you would train the rest of your body as aggressively as possible, and just not do anything that would provoke or damage the surgical site. That takes a little bit of a dance, but when you know it and you know the song, like, you can do it. That's you know, you can be in a sling and train. Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So, and then developing all of those good things helps that heal faster. That's valuable.
Done that many times. I've actually been a little bit, I think other people would consider reckless, but I've been through like multiple like hand breaking or like leg breaking or like little surgeries, and somehow I'd always be like in a prep for a bodybuilding competition at the same time. Yeah, and
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, they'd always be like, the doctors would be like, don't do anything or be in the gym for like 6 weeks plus or something. I'm like, that's crazy.
Yeah, and, I think the likelihood that you know more about training than the doctor is very, very high. He or she may know more about putting bones back together that when you break your wrist. But Niall, the standard for anybody, basic levels, good form, does it hurt? That doesn't mean you don't train it, but like, that's where like coaching 101 starts. Like, what is good form and does it hurt?
Yeah.
So we just use the same standards when someone has an active recovery that has to be immobilized. So now good form, like, okay, we're going to use different exercises. You're not going to move the arm in the sling. And then does it hurt is a word that I made up. This is not scientific. No reverb. Meaning you can't do a bicep curl on your right side if you feel anything on your shoulder. Because, you know, creating tension throughout your whole body, if that gets into the shoulder that isn't supposed to be having tension, you just use lighter weight to not create the tension. So you have less protocols if there's reverb in that area.
Gotcha.
And that's the same standards we would use. And that's where, you know, training for hormones, whether you're taking anything or not, training for hormones, training for immune system and the cardiovascular efficiencies, things heal faster. They just do. Like, how would they not? You're just creating hormones from inside your body instead of from taking it from outside your body. So that's, we would run the same protocol that protocol we would typically use for high level athletes. Then we use it for general population post-surgical, but they still have to have a high training age. But that's where the mitochondria, you just can't put it there when it's a rotator cuff repair. You can put it everywhere else. And when you stimulate it, yeah, if you're using your legs, of course, you're going to put more mitochondria in your legs. But it's not like the stimulus doesn't go through the whole body. And that's, you know, very valuable, very, very valuable. And then all of a sudden, like, I think there is research, and both anecdotal and real research, that certain things, fractures particularly, because you can measure the fracture, you can x-ray it, you can test it. We would never suggest beating the protocol or gnawing the cast off. But in those situations, we absolutely believe that the bone, and the research would support that the bone is healed much faster than 6 weeks.
Gotcha.
It has to.
So like, if it's like super localized, well, I guess it's localized and systematic, right? If you're if you have like an injury in your left shoulder, would you be primarily focusing on doing that stuff with your legs, or would you also be doing it with your right shoulder?
Both. You know, we would look at it as, what would we do with this person if they did not have this compromise on the left shoulder? What does our program look like? Like, what's the perfect program? And then we're like, okay, back squat. Well, we can't do that because he can't put his left shoulder on the sleeve. Mm-hmm. So why am I doing back squat? We're doing that for lower body strength. Cool. I'm pretty sure back squat is not the only exercise on earth that can deliver lower body strength. So we're staying in our plan so that this no man's land when you are ready to go is minimized. So now, if I was going to do figurative 4 to 8 repetitions to failure, because we talked about it before, there's many, many ways you can do this. Okay, so I can't do back squat 4 to 8 repetitions to failure. Can we do the safety bar where the shoulder's not? Well, no, he has to be in a sling. Okay, just skip a bunch of steps and go to leg press and put the pins there, or you put your buddies on the sides and you go to work. And now, I don't think leg press has an enormous carryover to back squat from a skill, but I'm pretty sure that we are going to elicit the same physiological environment. And we also know that training your legs has value to your upper body. I mean, you might see guys that the opposite is not always true. You'll see diesel dudes up top and chicken legs. And some of that might be genetic as well. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to see anybody that has huge, you know, squat and huge deadlift and be skinny up top. Like it doesn't seem to work that way. So yeah, that's how you would pick it. And so then a similar example, on Tuesdays we would bench press. So why am I bench pressing? Upper body strength. Well, I can't use this left arm. Let's do one arm dumbbell. And there is zero concern that one side is going to get giant while the other side doesn't, because you're creating this hormonal effect and that side is already being stimulated from all of the physiological demands post-surgically. So you're giving it what it wants.
Mm.
Now you also have imaging. Now the problem when you do imaging is like, you can't just think about your shoulder doing your press. So you have to actually take the same amount of time. So if I'm going to do 10 reps on my right arm and then I'm going to stand there and I close my eyes, I have to take the same amount of time to visualize my other arm moving. So you can, but just training on one side will have a homolateral is called. So like homo, like one side, same side,
yeah.
Lateral. So if I train this will get something, whether you're surgical or not. So there's when it comes to like rehab in those types of situations, we want to get as close to your normal training as possible. The next best step is to focus on what I call those primary qualities, all of which would help anything heal faster. It doesn't have to be the way to train because sometimes it's hard to get into those things. But yeah, we would focus a lot on lower body and we just train. And that's all of a sudden, you're telling your brain that, like, you're good. We will never, ever jump the protocol. That's reckless. Never jump the protocol. What we'll do is, once the protocol gets to the next checkpoint, you're going to be able to tolerate more. But we're not going to, like, skip steps. It's not worth the, you know, something goes sideways, you're going to fry. Like, it's not professional. It's not proper, etc. If there is a reason to immobilize. Now, there's a balance to that. And that's where some of the Aaron Rodgers stuff that was more positive. I think the science of particularly tendon repair, mm-hmm. is faster than the orthopedic surgery protocols. And that, mm-hmm. that opens up a lot of different topics in terms of hierarchy of authority. Meaning, at what point is the surgeon smarter or make the rules? Like, the surgeon does the surgery. He or she has a seat at the table. Now that's fantasy land, and I get to work in fantasy land a lot. But I also you also have to respect that he or she was the first one to paint the picture, and we need to continue to paint the picture in the same way. But the reality is, for something that is, you know, immobilized for 6 weeks, if you did a little bit, it would be better. And we're probably getting there. You would see some protocols are more aggressive, but I do think the science is would say that we should be doing more. And that might have very well been what Aaron Rodgers did. He did a little bit with some really intelligent, I don't know who he works with, maybe they did a little bit because the system trusted that what they were doing was actually safe and appropriate. So it's that see, everything has a, if you're going to make comment, if I'm going to make a statement, then it has to be both good and bad, and we have to discuss. Mm-hmm. So now if I have a great relationship with a surgeon, of which I have many, and there is value, like we got to be back by week 13, or I need to be able to ski with my daughter on her 16th birthday, whatever the reason is, not for me to decide. I'm like, all right, well, we got to take a little bit of risk. And if we follow the science, I'm seeing that those risks are not too dangerous.
Let's jump to this Q&A real quick, because we actually just ran out of time, but
oh wow,
I still want to ask some of them. So the Boof Lord asks, advice for hip flexor / lower back issues and tightness.
It's unfortunately very vague. So I think something you can start to consider with back pain is what's called a directional preference. Does it hurt more or less when you bend forward or when you bend backwards? And often it'll be one versus the other. And if you could find that, well, then we're going to train very, very hard. Maybe it means split squats instead of deadlifts for a period of time. When your hip flexors are tight, is there a way that we can test in multiple positions? Meaning, you know, if your hip flexor is tight standing, what about when you kneel on one knee, do like a hip flexor stretch? What about when you're on all fours? Is there a way, can somebody do it passively? Like, can you go to your guy and stretch his hip flexor? Because sometimes what is tight doesn't feel tight. Sometimes what feels tight isn't actually tight. Because you're allowed to say whatever you want of how it feels. Mm-hmm. But if I can move it passively and it's not that tight, then it's more of a stability issue, of which different types of exercises would be, like it would look the same and it would feel the same. But then when you run different tests, then you can see that no, this we shouldn't be stretching this hip flexor. We should be working on the glutes. We should be working on glute medius. We should be working on balance, you know, something else that forces the muscles to act properly so that these ones in the front don't constantly feel tight.
Right.
Please, if there's more that this person wants, I'll be happy to answer offline, but I need more. I can't, it's very nebulous.
Gotcha. Glenn Lenihan asks, what to do for persistent runner's knee when taking time off quads and cycle hasn't helped?
So if indeed this is a confirmed tendinopathy, that can be tendinitis usually will last two or three days as a word. You know, you call it whatever you want. Like if it's confirmed that it's the tendon, then I'm going to say this one, I can be specific, but I don't know that that's his problem. But if we know it's a patellar tendinopathy, you're going to get into the baddest leg extension machine you can get. You can put the seat as far forward. You put the pads behind you and you're going to get
seat it forward.
Because I want your knee flexed as absolute far as possible. So think about if you're more forward, you're going to be able to bend your knee under more.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So
sitting far forward.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. So like, but totally different. The hoist garbage. Because you like, you know, because you see it moves, like you can't get that deep knee flexion.
Yeah.
So here's what I want. I'm trying to use a good illustration. I don't care. The company's trash. I hate those machines. Like they move. Like who thought this was cool? Like this is terrible. So basically, you want to get into a position where you're sitting, and your foot is cranked behind you as far as possible. It doesn't have to be a machine. But that's the best way, because now your quad is slacked. I think we mentioned this a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So now when you put the pin at the bottom of the machine, and if you can budget, put a plate on it, put another plate on it, put those new bands that go on. I want 100% isometrics, 100% isometric leg extension. You're allowed to feel pain up to like around a 4 out of 10. Mm. 30 second hold, ruthless, but you have to ramp into it. So it's like, ramp into it so you can't go fast, but then you're going to move this, you're going to try to move this immovable object. Because the quad is slacked, you will likely transfer most of your tension to the tendon. Your protocol, which can be done twice a day, and there's a bunch of other things that you can do in conjunction in terms of when you have caffeine, when you take epicatechin chocolate. This is all evidence-based. But how do I focus on the tendon? I get it long, just like your bodybuilding stuff. I slack out the muscle. So I still have to use the muscle to move the tendon. I can't put any tension into the tendon without the muscle, but I'll minimize the muscle. Four rounds, 30 seconds, 2 minutes rest. So you have total of 2 minutes of work and then 6 minutes of rest. That would be the elite protocol that I would use. So let's say if it was for a calf, it doesn't have to be tendon. If it's for a calf, we get into the leg press, you put as many wheels on as you can, you put the pin all the way at the top. So you just get this stretch. Again, like stretch is like, I guess the research that was most applicable to bodybuilding is more new. This isn't really new. That's why I'm asking the question is in bodybuilding, is that deep stretch create hypertrophy of connective tissue. Or contractile? And mm-hmm. my suspect is that it's connective tissue, because remember, you can't lift as much. Mm-hmm. So you're using less weight than what your muscles have shown, but because it's all about the angle. But look, keep doing it. It's a good thing. But that's your guy's patellar tendon mm-hmm. protocol. You can do that twice a day.
Yeah. Everyone loves the new research on the stretch. Everyone. So RP, you know, Dr. Mike.
Yeah.
They're just blowing up.
He's so entertaining.
It's so entertaining, bro.
He's really good.
Yeah. I love the guy. He's really cool. Let's see. Actually that had me thinking. So I've been trying to do a lot of like stretch mediated hypertrophy with my quads, trying to grow them as much as possible on the leg extension machine. And I actually would put the seat as far back as possible, then sit forward on the seat. So that way I can hip extend and then.
Yeah. It's still relative because your hip is still flexed. Mm-hmm. That we need this magical hip extension machine. Knee extension machine that's done standing. So like you're standing and your foot goes behind you and somehow there's a band pulling your foot up so that when you extend down, so now your hip is extended, rectus femoris is in play. That means the quad is not slacked out. That's where I wonder if people struggle with mass of their quads. Mm-hmm. Is it because that the rectus femoris is really not getting stimulated? I don't know if that's the answer or not. If somebody wants to say, I'm going to ask. Right. That's fine. But
I'm sure that, and then also like the genetic portion. Too.
I mean, I think it's always flattering. Like, you know, we run this joke, you know, as long as I look like I can suplex everybody in the room, I'm good. my upper body is obviously way bigger than my lower body, but the bulk of my development of training was sitting back into a squat and deadlift. Mm-hmm. Like I never even did leg extensions and I certainly never squatted straight down or never did leg press. So the bulk of my development was always to be strong and explosive in my legs. So maybe that's why I don't have big legs. I don't know. Like mm-hmm. But maybe it's genetic. I don't know.
I think that's a big actually contributing factor though, what you're saying. Cause I did the same where I wasn't being explosive, but my training regimen was not optimized for hypertrophy with legs for like the longest time. I was just trying to rep out four plates for as many reps as possible, which would be like 7 to 8 reps.
Yeah.
But now I do like 20 rep sets and I'll do like 3 5-5 second eccentrics and I'll do like the greatest stretch possible. And my legs have been growing. So.
Good. You got it. I would say though, you know, if a general population, somebody like that wasn't like super serious, like, hey, how do I do this? Like bodybuilding, dude, just go 6 to 15 reps as heavy as you can, stay in that range, you know, and then play around with your reps team with how you feel like it. So that's what you were doing. You were 7, 8, you're in there, but I don't know.
Except I was sticking to it the entire time.
Yeah.
And now that I know that I'm, you know, type 1 fiber responsive, it's like, well,
that's interesting.
Makes a lot of sense.
That's interesting because then that opens up a whole genetics, epigenetics. But also development. Like that's when my ego is saying I have small legs because of my development, because I was really good. And I don't really know if I have hypertrophy in my hamstrings and my glutes. I don't really know. I don't see them. I do know in powerlifting and when you show up to a meet, it's like the motherfuckers that look big from behind, they're the ones that are strong. It doesn't matter what they look like in the front. They look like a badass and from behind, they're the ones.
What are your thoughts on sissy squats?
Tell me what it is, because it might be two different, multiple different things.
It's where you're like basically you're standing, your hip is totally extended, and then you like kneel to the ground. Or yeah, you're like kneeling to the ground, and you do like a leg extension to push your, to like.
Is it the one where like there's that video where somebody blows out their knee?
Oh man, I don't know if I've seen that video.
So
it's like if you're standing like this, yeah, and you go like that and then you go back up.
Oh yeah. So yeah. Again, I would probably put, so I know what that is, and again, it's good form, doesn't hurt. Like if it, but yeah, that I given the, what do you call it, like the inefficiency of that movement, you're probably doing something good for connective tissue, not strength. Now, you can challenge that by saying, well, Charlie, I've been doing it for 3 weeks, or 3 months, and all of my other strength lifts went up. I would say because you properly developed collagen and titan, which then supports your eccentrics, you know, like and that would then allow you to use more of your contractile tissue. So it all works. It all works.
Nice.
But yeah, that I think that exercise, given the movement demand, number one, do you have the joints to do it in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, like, you know, do you look relatively controlled and athletic? And there are probably people that don't. So it's a good thing, but maybe not good for everybody.
Aaron Friel says suggestions for compressed C5 and C6 causing loss of strength in the shoulder.
If you really are honest about the strength loss, you need to get medical, you know, intervention. Whether it's mechanical or fluid, meaning inflammation, et cetera, that's compressing the nerve to the point that you have muscle strength loss,
mm-hmm,
you're in trouble. That's because if that inflammation or whatever the cause of the nerve being denervated, it can die. Like it needs to be removed. Sometimes it's just taking a steroid, a corticosteroid, like a Medrol dose pack or something. Obviously that has to be prescribed by a physician, and you just take the pressure off the nerve and then you have to retrain it. If that's what's going on here, there are, you know, manual therapies, there's active exercise that can, when performed correctly without pain, increase space in C5, C6, or any, you can pick any joint in the body almost. So those are all options. If somebody is asking us on a podcast, I would say, I hope that the value in asking us is that you should, you know, find a competent medical person, whether it's a physician, chiro, physiotherapist, because if that doesn't get better, the nerve, if it goes long enough, the nerve does, it takes years, if ever, for the nerve to return, if that's what's going on here. Just because your shoulder hurts and it's hard to move and your neck seems to be stiff, that doesn't mean you have C5, C6 compression. If you do, Let's get on top of this. Like there's a way to, you find some good people. Usually the best people are not convenient. Like they're not in network. They're not close. Yeah, you have to pay out of pocket. Like that's, I find that I'm saying, like, how do I use a safe word that doesn't really piss people off or really fire them up? Try to maximize your inconvenience to choose your medical provider.
Wow.
Most medical people suck. But they're in my network. Okay, like I made no comment on your financial value of your health. You know, this person is garbage. Like that doesn't mean they're a bad person. Like you can suck at your job and be a really good person and really want to help.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you know, if that individual does go the physician route, we need them, but then they seem to take control all the time. And to think that a physician knows how to rehab 5-6 and a peripheral nerve compression. Good. Let me know who that physician is. I'd like to learn about him because that he or she doesn't know that. They know other things. And mm-hmm. to think that any one professional, like I don't know how to do a decompression of 5-6. Like I don't know how to do a surgery. That's why, you know, you try to create a team of people that are like-minded and are good at communicating with each other, because then you as the patient or the athlete, you benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen very often, unfortunately.
No, gotcha.
Yeah, that's not the case.
Ong Fitness asks, PED use in the NBA. Have always heard the testing is behind the curve.
I'm glad you heard that. I don't know. Like it's I'm not going to say.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know. Like, what if I say it is or it isn't? I'm not sure. I would have to then support my statement of one mm-hmm. or the other. And I'm sorry, I can't do that.
Josh the Human asks, can you catch up to current powerlifting champions?
Can I? No.
Can no. I? I'm trying to understand what he's It says, can you catch up, in quotes, to current powerlifting champions?
So I actually don't know what the numbers are right now. From what I see in powerlifting right now, it seems like it's like dudes that are 400 pounds, mm-hmm. you know, doing some really cool things. I don't see guys weighing 198 and 181, you know, doing cool things, at least on social media. Mm-hmm. I was at the Olympia where the WPO, like there was like three powerlifting competitions all in a row in the back. Mm-hmm. And I knew one of them was like IPF or whatever, where they only wear one ply and they're like high and mighty, where the referees wear like suits. Like, this is a joke. Then there was another one, or maybe that was like strongman in the middle. And then it was WPO. So WPO would have been the pinnacle of where I was. And I was not close to that, you know, I dropped off before that. And there were dudes that was, you know, 308, or I don't even know the weight class. These are like guys way bigger than me. And I'm like, I text my guy, you know, he was one of the all time greats at Westside. I'm not going to say, cause I don't want people to, if they don't want to be a part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yo, if you weigh 200 pounds more, you know, 250 pounds more than me, you have to squat more than 100 pounds more than me. Like, it was a joke what I was seeing. Now, Dave Hoff was, you know, from Westside. He's still, you know, clearly the highest total of all time. And I think he was in that meet. But when I'm like, oh my God, like, this is silly. So can I personally catch up? No. Like, I got out of it not so much because my body couldn't handle it. I didn't have time. Like, my life changed. And like, yo, when you have work sets with 7 and 8 wheels, you have to warm up. Like, nobody just goes to, like, it takes time, and then you got to put your gear on. And if you don't have a crew, like, it doesn't work. Like, you can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'll be the guy that looks strong, even if I'm not that strong anymore. but no, I, if that's the question, I personally can't. Mm-hmm. It's the amount of time, and then the amount of where I'm at in my age, like, I couldn't fuck with it.
Oh, you actually said something at one of the podcasts that I was curious about. What was it? You made a distinction between muscle mass between muscle mass and power, and that power is like the quality that we lose the fastest as we age. And it's a lot more meaningful in an expression of like your internal structure. So I was wondering, like, what age do you tend to see like power reduce the most? And
interesting.
What would you recommend for people?
I don't know the longevity. I don't know the actual age. That's a good question, and if you're going to make a statement like that, I think I should know that. But as you age, I think what that comment would be supported by the literature would be, as you age, you lose the expression of power faster than you lose the expression of strength or mass. Mm. So power is more of a real life activity. Like how we move in a house, or, you know, reaching for things, or driving, or dressing. These are inherently powerful exercises because we have very, very relative high speeds compared to lifting, and there's like no weight. Mm-hmm. So this is power. So I don't know the age, but if we never stop training fast sprints, if you missed all that, the little old ladies sprinting is like the agility ladder, like, so they can do something relatively fast. You know, training, you're moving your med ball. You know, again, if you can't jump, you can kind of bounce and stick. Mm-hmm. So, but then when you can jump, like, these are all things that can just be scaled for somebody who's older. Mm-hmm. The agility ladder, believe it or not, is probably something that has questionable utility for a young athlete. Maybe it's good for warm up. That's about it. Like, you're not going to get fast from this. That's why I don't call it a speed ladder. It's not how it works. You know, you see studs like doing all these moves. Like, that doesn't even happen in sport, much less it doesn't create an adaptation that mm-hmm. you can express. But the speed ladder has value. The agility ladder has value for that old person. Like, just putting their foot in and out creates coordination. And if they can just do it as fast as they can, they're still training, because power is two things. It's a combination of tissue stiffness, where the tendon is more stiff than the muscle. That's how you can be fast and powerful, but not very strong. Guys can jump 40 inches and, run, 9.8, but they're not like, they can't lift a lot of weight because that's just not what a power athlete is. It's like powerlifting is like this oxymoron. The other thing though is your brain. Like are you wired? Like your rate of force development. And that can be trained just like anything else. You have to train, if you're going to be fast, you have to train to move fast and train your brain to do this. The only way to do that is to set up the exercise and the load so that you can be fast. But then over time, for somebody who, if using these concepts before you run out and age has hit you, when you're bench pressing 500 pounds, you're trying to move as fast as you can. It just doesn't go very fast because there's five wheels on the bar. Mm-hmm. You always train rate of force development. And this is the support for like what many of us know is conjugate. That would be a very specific version would be applied at Westside. So that you train dynamic effort method where you're constantly focused on sub-maximal loads, moving them as absolute fast as possible so that your brain is still going to do that when you do your max effort lifts. The bar just doesn't go as fast. You achieve limit or maximal strength in one effort while you train rate of force development in the other. So anything that would make the person move fast is going to be very, very useful. But I'm sorry, I don't know the age of when that happens. I do know the age never happens if you keep doing it. We see videos of 100-year-old people running, and they're not running very fast. Mm-hmm. But for them, that's maximal rate of force development. That's powerful.
Gotcha. Awesome. So I have one last question that I ask everyone at the end of every podcast. So if you had one small message that you could send to the entire world, if you were to hypothetically die tomorrow, what would that message be?
Oh, man. I think about dying again, huh? guys, I'm like a living meme. Every spiritual Instagram post is like about me. So there's probably a lot of things I would love to say, but I think it's not just do unto others as you would like done to yourself. But remember, maybe I'll run with this one because I've been saying it a lot. Do unto others as you want done to yourself. And always remember that multiple things can be true. And if you have layers to the relationship with any person or thing, if you lose one, you still have substance. But if you only have one thing that connects people with, meaning you and I, the only thing that we really connected on is this podcast. If this went terrible, we probably would never communicate because there's no depth to our relationship. But now if we had a very positive time, there's a chance to add something else and something else and something else. So if you lose something with someone, you can still keep the relationship. Mm-hmm. It's about layers. Mm-hmm. It's about depth. And if you can understand that you don't have to agree or like what someone else is doing, then it's cool as long as you have these other things and you just don't talk. So when it comes to training, et cetera, I'm like, yo, this is what I do. Like, yes, I think I am the best in the world. You should think that too. Otherwise, what are you doing? Like, are you intentionally doing B-level work? Now, I don't step out that. I don't talk about it. This is about answering a question. But don't confuse me for someone who cares. Like, now, if I'm going to listen and show respect, because I'll take that hubris and then balance it with the humility that I will change what I'm doing at a moment's notice if I hear whoever you is say, man, holy shit, like that is a better way to do it. I'm going to try that. And I think if we can take all of that and put it into a blender, that's do unto others as you want done to yourself. Like it's okay. Like we don't all have to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. But because many of us probably listening here are some type of athletic mindset. That doesn't mean we're athletes and we play sports, but athletes win. That's what we're wired to do. I'm guessing most people. I know I am. I'm wired to win. It's one of the only things I'm like really good at. I just want to win. And you don't have to win every single one. And there's more like the tribalism of training methods means that I hate you if you don't do what I do. And that sucks. I get that way too much. Cause you see, I'm very open in my communication. But if you asked, what do I think of so-and-so, I wouldn't have answered because I probably don't even know that person. Mm-hmm. But you probably would have asked because you would have the knowledge or intuition that they are completely diametric to what I do. I go left, they go right. I'm like, so now if I say, no, I believe going left is dumb, this is why I go right. Automatically, there's this implication because of we're athletes that we hate each other. And I don't want that. Like, right. And I probably fell into those traps when I was younger. And everything I'm talking about right now has all been from experience. Everything mm-hmm. that we talked about for however long we've been talking mm-hmm. is all I've done it. I've either done it myself. I've done it with killers. And it's all been based on errors, like mistakes. And look, when you have a big parachute, it's cool. You can make mistakes. Not everybody has the same parachute. I understand, but that's really what I would like. And it's not one thing, but it's a message of, it's cool. It's everything's going to be cool. Like we don't have to agree. You know, your bills are not, I'm not paying for your kid's college. Like you do it. And when you can put that focus, then it's cool. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. What matters is that you get yours and hopefully you can share a little bit, not money, but hopefully share who you are as a person with others in other spaces and lanes other than the ones that, man, motherfuckers just want to blast. Mm-hmm. That would be, I'm glad you gave me a little chance to say something like that. Cause it's not often people want to know more about mitochondria and what happens in the NBA. I think sometimes, cause I have a lot of stuff like that. I learned a lot of that in the Marine Corps. But I don't think people, I'm like my own, what's the word? My own self-esteem or my own, comfort level. I don't know that people always want to hear me say that stuff. So mm-hmm. that's what maybe why I was verbose.
Thanks, man. That was awesome. So thanks for coming on the podcast. Cool. Where can everybody find you?
So my website is charlieweingroff.com. I'm guessing by the time you hear this, it'll be the new website. And then chweingroff on Instagram. Between the website and Instagram, there's a lot of content, which would have probably started in like 07 or 08. So there's a search engine on the website. Instagram should keep you busy for a little bit. We're pretty active in getting stuff out there. So hopefully you find some things that are interesting. And I have never not responded to someone in my career, ever. So if anybody messages, might not be the answer you want. Like if somebody asks me something generic and vague, I'm not going to know how to answer. There's other douchebags out there that'll be happy to tell you exactly what to do and only remember the two times it helped somebody instead of the eight times people got really jacked up. Diagnosis by internet doesn't work, mm-hmm. but if there's a concept, I'll be happy to answer. And I've never, even with calls, it was, I've never not responded to somebody cause, I might've been that person. Now if they're talking crazy shit, like I'm like, you know, I still respond in some way, but I don't engage.
Cool. Thank you, bro. Thanks. All right, man. Everybody, if you would like to support the podcast, you can by rating us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you find your podcasts and subscribing to the YouTube channel and clicking the bell button. Cause that's how we get bigger, greater guests like today. So thanks for coming on again, man. That was awesome. That was epic.
Well done.
Honestly, I think I learned more in this podcast than I did in the last like 3 months. So
only 3 months. Cool. Thank you, man.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, man. All right. Peace, guys.
Sick.